how many kits do our law enforcement agencies have, and why weren't they submitted?
The state says it needs more resources to process thousands of untested sexual assault kits. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 2nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, an unusually high number of Black Alaskans are running for the legislature.
It's been an honor to run with all of them because I think all of us have a diversity of background and experience.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Alaska's rising crime has become a central point of contention in the closing days of the race to be governor. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on what the candidates have said about crime in recent debates.
The debates have focused on the criminal justice overhaul passed 2 years ago, known as Senate Bill 91. SB 91 drew from research that suggests that reduced criminal sentences can actually lead to reduced crime. The law allowed some low-risk offenders to avoid jail time. It also changed sentencing, bail and probation, and funded drug treatment. But it's prompted a fierce backlash from residents and police, upset over rising crime. The legislature has passed two major laws to scale back the overhaul. Republican candidate Mike Donlavey said during a debate hosted by Alaska Public Media and KTUU Channel 2 that despite the changes to the bill, he still opposes it.
I would repeal it because the people of Alaska have lost trust in this bill. And I believe that we could do better. I believe that we can fill in the holes that are in 91 and, again, restore that trust with the people of Alaska.
Democratic candidate Mark Begich said during another debate on KTVA that he'd, quote, clear the deck, end quote, of what's left of SB 91. But he'd replace it with what he describes as a comprehensive plan.
If you just get wrapped around 91, you're missing the big picture, which is fighting crime in this state.
His plan includes more treatment, as well as more state aid to municipalities to hire police officers. To fill vacant trooper, corrections, and prosecutor positions, Begich says he'd expand recruitment and training while offering defined benefit pensions to compete with the lower 48. Donlavey says public safety would be the highest priority for the state budget.
That's the primary purpose of a state, of any government, is to provide safety for its citizens. The last 4 years, we've all changed our behaviors. I don't think there's any of us that know of anyone that has not been impacted by crime, either directly or indirectly.
Donlavey says he would fund his public safety initiatives by reducing the number of state government jobs that are budgeted for but aren't filled. There might not be much money available. Begich emphasizes that of the positions the state does fund but hasn't filled, many are in public safety, where the state has struggled to successfully recruit and retain troopers. He says that if unspent money was available, conservative lawmakers would have found it during the fiscal crisis.
Because I guarantee you, the Senate, especially with Pete Kelly at the lead, would have found that money and used it in some way without having to worry about dealing with taking the permanent fund.
Donlavey wants to hire more officers and prosecutors with the goal of arresting and jailing more people who commit crimes.
We have to get the right number of troopers in place. We have to get the right number of prosecuting attorneys to move our cases through. We have to open up the courts Friday afternoon instead of closing it Friday afternoon. And we have to look at corrections to make sure that we have the right number of folks there because there will be a bit of an increase in folks going into prison.
Begich also supports increasing the number of troopers and prosecutors. But in response to rising drug-related crime, Begich also emphasizes drug treatment and using wellness courts. They divert offenders into treatment programs.
80% of our folks in corrections need the treatment necessary, those that want to have it. Wellness courts are another great investment. I've seen the turnaround. 90% of the people who go through wellness courts do not reoffend. It's the right kind of investment to have a long-term impact.
Begich also says tribal courts could be expanded in Alaska Native communities with a similar goal of reducing recidivism. Begich added he wants to fix a gap in the drug treatment system. People who leave prison have 28 days of medication to treat their addiction, but Medicaid coverage only begins after 30 days. Don Levy also says treatment is a priority for him. Voters will decide on Tuesday. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The state says it is chipping away at the thousands of backlogged and untested sexual assault kits. But officials with the Department of Public Safety stress that recent progress is partially due to one-time grant funds and that it needs more resources to keep up with higher demands for DNA testing. Today, the Department of Public Safety released its annual legislative report on its statewide inventory of rape kits. Though down from last year, the crime lab still has almost 2,600 kits from police departments all around the state that were previously unsubmitted and untested for DNA matches. One reason for that high number is that in recent years, the department centralized protocols for how sexual assault kits from police departments statewide are tested and stored long-term. Michelle Collins supervises forensic biology for the sexual assault team and says national attention on rape kit backlogs led the state to audit and overhaul its collection system.
So Alaska has started looking at that as well, and it started with a inventory statewide of how many kits do our law enforcement agencies have and why weren't they submitted.
As recently as 2017, kits would remain untested in a local police department when the victim wished to remain anonymous, or if police thought DNA would not further an investigation, or if prosecutors didn't think a case was strong enough to bring charges. Priority is generally given to cases involving serious violence or an imminent threat to the public. Collins says now the state will more uniformly collect and retain rape kits.
We want to test, even if it's not needed to prosecute that case, we still want to test that kit and determine if there's data there that may be useful in other cases.
Under a federal grant meant to reduce sexual assault kit backlogs, several hundred samples have been sent out of state for testing at a private lab. The money is also being used to study and implement best practices on how to coordinate with the state's 48 separate law enforcement agencies. But officials say without more staff and resources budgeted from the legislature, the backlog in kits will grow again. In its report, the department is asking lawmakers to add around $700,000 more dollars for expanded forensic testing. Well, Governor Bill Walker is using his final weeks in office to urge his Canadian counterpart in British Columbia to toughen regulations on mines in transboundary watersheds. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, it's a position fisheries advocates have been pushing for.
A mine can't legally operate in Alaska unless the owner makes financial assurances it can pay for remediation. Basically, that's cleaning things up to a point that satisfies regulators.
Here in Alaska, we require that mines put up a full reclamation bond that shows that a mine can clean up its mess, and that is not required in British Columbia.
Heather Hardcastle is with Salmon Beyond Borders, a group that campaigns against transboundary mine pollution. Her group has been urging Alaska's governor to demand the same from British Columbia. On Wednesday, she got her wish after Governor Walker penned a two-page letter to his counterpart demanding financial assurances.
This letter, in multiple paragraphs, mentions it multiple times. So it makes it very clear that financial assurances are a priority for Alaska.
Ephraim Froelich is the governor's fisheries advisor. He said recent contacts between the Walker administration and BC's Minister for Mines made it apparent the province wasn't enthusiastic about adding that requirement.
And so it made it very clear the governor had to make Alaska's position crystal clear for the other side.
Salmon advocates like Hardcastle applaud the new position.
It's much more forceful in tone than previous letters, and I think it perfectly encapsulates the frustration that all of us are feeling right now with British Columbia and Canada.
The frustration is also felt by some in the Walker administration. That's because there's precedent for mine operators in BC going bankrupt and walking away. Just upstream from Taku Inlet near Juneau, the former Tulsiqua Chief Mine across the border has been leaching acid runoff for decades. The Taku River is an important salmon fishery in southeast. Meanwhile, there's a booming mining sector in BC with additional metals mines being proposed just over the border.
We're not going to be able to have confidence in British Columbia's reclamation abilities of these mines that they are permitting at a pretty high rate if we do not see Tulsiqua Chief be remediated and be cleaned up and properly dealt with.
The Walker administration's days are numbered. Froelich said the letter states Alaska's position clearly for whoever occupies the governor's mansion next month.
We would hope that whatever administration comes in next takes a strong stance.
The BC Premier's office referred questions to the Ministry of Mines, which didn't respond by deadline. Calls to the Mining Association of British Columbia weren't returned. Walker's letter comes at a time that BC is reviewing its mine reclamation laws. Public comment is accepted through November 8th. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, using opera to tell the story of a tragedy at sea.
And in a lot of ways, I think it's perfect just because it can capture that depth of emotion.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you need health insurance for 2019? Alaska's individual market health insurance rates have dropped by more than 28% in the last 2 years. Most Alaskans who sign up at healthcare.gov are eligible for tax credits to help pay the costs. Open enrollment is November 1st through December 15th this year. Check out healthcare.gov to find out what your insurance options are for 2019. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
Alaska's legislature has always been overwhelmingly white. Even in the most diverse areas of the state, white Alaskans have almost always been elected to serve in Juneau. But this year's general election has an unusually high number of black Alaskans on the ballot. And as Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, most of them are running as Republicans.
State House candidate Marilyn Stewart grew up in a family of Democrats in Alabama. Her first political job in Alaska was with Democratic Governor Tony Knowles in community relations. Stewart later joined the Republican Party when she began to feel the Democratic Party wasn't doing enough to elevate people from lower economic standings, especially for black Alaskans like her.
I would hear things like, well, we got to get those people to the polls to vote. Who in the black community should we reach out to that can galvanize these people and get them to the polls to vote? Versus in the Republican Party, the conversation that we're having is this, is that we want prosperity, we want business opportunity for all.
Now a Republican running in District 21 in Anchorage, Stewart is a minority in several ways. A little less than 4% of the state is black. And a Pew Research study found that about 10% of black people in America identify as conservative, with 3% calling themselves Republicans. If that holds true in Alaska, Stewart falls in a demographic that's less than 0.5% of the state's population. This year, there are 7 black Alaskans running for the legislature, 6 for the House and 1 for the Senate. It's an unusually high number. Anchorage NAACP President Kevin McGee says he's never seen so many black candidates on the ballot.
Not to my knowledge, and like I said, I've been here since 73.
And 4 of the candidates are black Republicans like Marilyn Stewart. Tuckerman Babcock chairs the Alaska Republican Party. He says the party doesn't go out of its way to recruit diverse candidates, but he says the party has been encouraging minority candidates who show interest in Republican politics to seek prominent roles.
People who have traditionally not given the Republican Party any thought, despite their being moderate or conservative themselves, now they realize that they are welcome, they are encouraged.
All 4 black Republicans running for the House ran unopposed in the primary elections, something Babcock attributed to the support of the party for these candidates. But they'll have an uphill battle to win the general election. All are running for office in districts that have been long represented by Democrats. Cesar Martinson is running to fill the District 20 seat of retiring Democratic Representative Les Guerra. Martinson says that he's encouraged that even if he and the other candidates don't all win, they are showing a diversity of thought among black Americans.
And it's been an honor to run with all of them because I think all of us have a diversity of background and experience that we have brought to our races and to the discussions that we're having around different issues. And I think it's really elevated the conversation.
One of the black candidates running for office who has a clearer path to victory is Democrat L.V. Gray Jackson, who's running for Senate District I, a traditionally liberal area. Gray Jackson has a career in Alaska politics that stretches back to the 90s. She's worked locally to help recruit diverse candidates for the Democratic Party, and she says that diversity for its own sake can't be a minority candidate's sole platform.
I happen to be African American, but the people that I'm going to represent are not all African Americans. We have a diverse community. I represent everybody. I work for all the people, not just people who've looked like me, but I work for all the people.
Local NAACP President McGee says that even though most black Alaskans identify with the Democratic Party, issues-focused campaigns are a common thread among all of the candidates running for office.
If people are honest with themselves, you know, you get an honest approach to seeking out solutions. Now, if you just go in there and say, okay, I'm a Democrat, and I'm only going to look at the Democratic side of things. No, that's not right either.
McGee says he's hopeful that seeing higher numbers of minority candidates in general will encourage those who thought politics wasn't for them to reconsider. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
The first two transgender women elected to public office in Alaska have been sworn in to their new jobs. Kathy Otterston is serving on the Fairbanks City Council for a one-year term, while Liz Like is serving on the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly for a three-year term. Both won their races at the municipal election in early October. Otterston and Like say being transgender is just one aspect of their lives, and they are much more than just that one term. They say they sought office to serve their neighbors, friends, and families. Otterston says she hopes the matter can become just as ordinary as saying what blood type a person is. The proposed Donlin Gold mine received several vital permits this year, and the company Donlin Gold expects to get most of the big state and federal ones this year. So where are they in the process? From Alaska's Energy Desk, Christy Schallenberger brings us this update from Bethel.
Donlin Gold is still waiting on some important state permits. So what are you guys doing in the permitting process? Have you received any new ones since the last?
We have not. The last one we received, I think, was the core permits and our Title 16 fish habitat permits.
That's Kurt Parkin, Donlin Gold spokesman. The Army Corps of Engineers joint record of decision that came out in August is the biggest milestone for the company so far in the permitting process. It capped 6 years of environmental review for the project, which could be one of the biggest gold mines in the world if developed. The Army Corps greenlighted the project in a joint decision with the Bureau of Land Management. BLM had to give Donlin permission to build a lengthy gas pipeline on some of its land. So, what other permits does Donlin have? Well, it has a wastewater discharge one from the state. This will let Donlin Gold discharge water from its mining operations into Crooked Creek, a tributary of the Kuskokwim River. And the state issued an air quality permit for Donlin last year. Third, the State Department of Fish and Game gave Donlin 13 permits in August for disrupting fish habitat. The mine would eliminate one salmon stream and partially destroy another. Now, what permits does Donlin hope to get before the end of the year? One is approval of its draft reclamation plans and financial assurances, which is basically how Donlin plans to set aside money for reclamation. But the Department of Natural Resources is still reviewing those plans, and it's unclear when it will approve them. DNR is the lead state agency for issuing permits under its jurisdiction and the Department of Environmental Conservation. DNR did not respond to requests for comment. Another permit Donlin hopes to get this year is a, quote, integrated waste permit from DEC. Parkin describes it this way.
That's the disposal of all material that's generated at the mine, like the waste rock and garbage and from the kitchen and water treatment plant sludge that collects and that sort of thing.
Parkin says that they're also expecting a public hearing from DNR within the next month or so for its right-of-way permit for the portion of the pipeline that goes through state-owned land. But Donlin still has a ways to go in the permitting process. It needs 100 permits to begin mining. And one major milestone won't come for a couple of years. It's dam safety permits.
The dam safety permit probably is the biggest permit that will be outstanding after this year.
Donlin needs these permits to build its tailings dam and other infrastructure. He says he doesn't know when the company will begin the necessary drilling and analysis to get those permits. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Annie Feit. This week on AK, Songs of Sorrow. The steamship Princess Sophia sank with an estimated 350 people 100 years ago near Juneau. Since the sinking corresponded with the end of World War I, it received little attention at the time. For some, this lack of attention left the tragedy without a sense of closure. In Juneau, a collaboration of producers and artists from across the country present the Princess Sophia Opera. In this preview, KTOO's Scott Burton wonders if art can offer closure.
Soft petals and dewdrops.
It's weeks before the opera premieres, and 100 people are on a boat next to Vanderbilt Reef in Lynn Canal. This tragedy's ground zero. Soprano Kathleen Wayne is literally floating above the wreckage of the Princess Sophia.
It's in a very emotional space to be in. 350 people lost their lives, children, mothers, fathers, young people.
Behind her, Vanderbilt Reef breaks the ocean's surface like a craggy land creature coming up for air. And mountains rise on all sides of the massive fjord.
You're right above them, singing about them, people nobody here has met, but feeling very connected with them through this music and these lyrics.
Sitting in the Juno
Another singer, tenor Bernard Holcomb, is in from New York rehearsing and researching. Because of the extreme tides and stormy weather, Holcomb's character, Captain Ledbetter, was among the Juno people who were unable to rescue anyone from the passenger ship.
I am accessing the feeling of guilt, the feeling of being out of control. I cannot control what is happening. That's incredibly frustrating.
As our modern diesel-powered catamaran safely circles the reef, it's hard not to imagine the suffering of all those people. Imagine being stuck on a reef in a storm with gale-force winds in 1918 on a steamship with little to no communication. Now remember that they were stranded like that for 40 hours before the ship sank.
Princess Sophia lullaby is about the ship actually singing to the people aboard, and I really think she's singing to the children, because lines in there, sleep children, wake with the dawn, that's beautiful here, the days aren't very long, and the nights are lovely, so just sleep and we'll wake with the morn. So I really think it's directed to those children to just be calm and it'll all be okay.
But it wasn't okay. All aboard perished, and in the static of the end of World War I, one of the worst maritime disasters of all time had little closure. And now, 100 years later, it's the anniversary of a tragedy. How do we honor that?
Opera is such a large, heavy emotion medium for expressing stories.
Todd Hunt is the opera's artistic director.
And in a lot of ways, I think it's perfect just because it can capture that depth of emotion and pull you along in a way that I personally think you couldn't fully pull off with, say, just a straight play.
It's hard to say what the opera will do or what it represents until the curtain falls. And, like most art does, it'll affect each person in a different way. Perhaps closure for some, commemoration for others, and maybe it's a way to feel what those people felt 100 years ago, but safely from a comfortable seat in the audience. In Juno, I'm Scott Burton.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Quinn Bennett in Anchorage. Bennett is a lifelong Alaskan who's done everything from outdoor guiding to teaching. He moved to Anchorage from Soldotna when he was 10 years old.
I don't know if it's rural versus urban or what it is, but at the time, moving up to Anchorage and to the big city, I was there was a culture difference in the sense of, you know, I didn't, my first curse words were learned here in Anchorage. The first time that I had any quote unquote adult or conversations were had in Anchorage. I didn't have any of that in Soldotna whatsoever. I'm a pretty big outdoorsy person, growing up especially, and today as well. I like to hike and backpack quite a bit. I work in the summers as a kayak guide and a glacier and ice climbing guide. So I'm always outside doing something. I have a 9-month-old now that's kind of slowed me down a little bit, but overall, we try and get even her outside quite a bit. The first camping she ever did was a tent camping, and she did better outside in the woods than she did at home at the time. She was sleeping, waking up every 20 to 40 minutes at home. We brought her outside, and she slept like a baby, if you could quote that. I think definitely I don't have anything to prove anymore. I still do solo stuff, but the big thing for me is, you know, if I'm going to do a 12-mile plus hike or go boating, I'm going to do it in a couple days, at least two. I don't need to push it. I don't need to test myself anymore. I don't need to try and climb the highest peak anymore. I don't need to try and climb these cliffs because I don't have anything else to prove at this point.
Quinn Bennett lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Scott Burton, Wesley Early, and Ammon Swenson. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I am Annie Feit.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Christy Schallenberger in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Ammon Swenson, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnosis and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile tools to help Alaskans succeed. Promises kept, trust earned since 1922. FNBAAlaska.com. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.